It is 8:30, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And 8:30 means one thing, at least here on Mind Over Matters, and that's that we have been joined by none other than Maria Tomczyk, co-editor at Eat the State. How are you this morning, Maria?
Good. I am none other than.
Yes. So I hope you've changed that on all your mailing labels.
None other than.
Yes. Maria's just your middle name. So no job today. He's off in...
New Mexico. He went to a friend's wedding, but he's also doing a couple speaking engagements down there.
All right. To pay for the friend's trip to the friend's wedding.
To help pay for the friend's wedding, no. All right. Just because he's a good guy, he'll do those free speaking engagements wherever he goes.
That's excellent. And of course, he's probably pushing some issues at Eat the State as well.
I hope so.
We should let people know that there is currently a demonstration happening as we speak.
Right now at 8:30, the Lillian Apartments, Paul Allen's Vulcan Company, wants to demolish them to make way for more development in the South Lake Union area. And housing advocates have charged that the Vulcan investments stripped the building. Instead of allowing it to be used for low-income housing, they stripped all the fixtures out of it to sell, and they've made the building an empty shell, an uninhabitable empty shell, and have gotten the permission of a judge to go ahead and demolish the building in spite of court case and appeals. And right now there are protesters down there to try and stop that process. So if you have a choice, you can listen to us and then go down at 9 o'clock, or you can go down right now, or you can go down and take a radio with you and listen to us on the way.
There you go. We like the third option. And the Lillian Apartments are located at 1258 John Street, which is two blocks west of REI.
Okay.
So 1258 John Street. Just look for the crowd. So it was... This week, our Mr. Bush, the current resident in the White House.
Yes, in fact, we had a number of demonstrations over the weekend, large ones. You probably heard about those on Counterspin. And in response, Bush gave a speech on Monday, which was supposed to make his case to the American people for allowing him war powers and the ability to invade Iraq at will. What I noted in his speech... is it hinged, the argument hinged on a phrase that he used, Saddam Hussein is unique. He stressed that Saddam Hussein and when he says Saddam Hussein is unique, he's saying that Saddam Hussein is the only person in the world who would attack U.S. citizens with weapons of mass destruction. Now, we know that that's not true. We've already been attacked by jetliners smashed into a large building, weapons of mass destruction. Which, and of course, they have nothing to do with nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons, but supposedly Saddam Hussein is unique. And what Bush cited in his speech, and what other members of the Bush administration have said about Saddam Hussein being unique, is that he wants to acquire weapons of mass destruction, or he already has them. They have said that he already has them, but we talked about that last week, how it's highly unlikely that he has any. They say that he wants to pass them on to terrorists. We talked about that a little bit last week, too, that the Iraqi administration has very few links to terrorist organizations in comparison to, say, Iran or Syria or Indonesia or Pakistan or any of a number of countries that are our allies. They said that, well, he tortures people, which is true. His government does torture people. In fact, we support many, many nations that engage in torture. I could name several: Indonesia, Pakistan, China, which has most favored nation trading status.
And didn't we just modify our laws so that it was okay for us to ship over people to countries that torture, so our FBI didn't have to do it directly?
Exactly. And that's the reason why many of the captured Taliban and Al-Qaeda folks are still in Pakistani prisons, is because they can use torture on them and we can get the benefit of that information. So the U.S. sanctions torture around the world. So I don't see how we can then hypocritically say that we're going after Saddam because he tortures people. He's a dictator. That's another excuse that Bush used. We support dictators all over the world. Saddam Hussein is not the only one. He is not unique in that respect. And you could argue that in some ways the Bush administration is a dictatorship. Bush was not elected to office. He was given a high office from a very, very conservative Supreme Court. And since then, Ashcroft and the Bush administration have done their best to demolish the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So you could argue that we're headed down that path as well. But the one thing that stood out that no one really can argue or has tried to argue is that Saddam Hussein has gassed the Kurds, as Bush called it, gassed his own people. But what we should know that even in that respect, Saddam Hussein is not unique. First of all, if we really want to look at who around the world has gassed their own people, we should start right here at home. Revelations were made this week that the U.S. government, the U.S. military, conducted experiments in which they used chemical and biological weapons. We use chemical and biological weapons on our own troops, some 5,500 of them, who didn't even really know the risks involved in taking part in these experiments. This is newly declassified information from the Pentagon.
Right, and that is on top of the ones they did with the civilians as well.
Yeah, and also we did the same experiments on Canadian and British troops too, probably without their knowledge. There remains at least 35 other incidents that are classified that we only know very, very few. That we only know that they happened. We don't know any of the details about them, and we also know of experiments conducted on civilian populations about here in the U.S. to test the dispersal of chemical and biological agents. Now, the current administration claims that those were, you know, inert substances, but we don't know for sure.
And that would also be on top of the nuclear tests we've done on our own people. For
exactly.
instance, just going over to Hanford, things called the Green Runs, where they would release what they knew at the time were highly radioactive nuclear particulates into the air just so they could see where it flowed to.
Mm-hmm.
And people are still...
Without regard to people who were in the way.
Right. They didn't warn people. They didn't do anything. And those people from the Second World War are still trying to get compensation and medical help for those.
Mm-hmm. Still trying to get some kind of acknowledgement even.
And we're talking hundreds of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm. We're not talking about tens of thousands like Bush is mentioning with Saddam Hussein. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of downwinders. So, you know, first there's our country. I mean, we have done that, you know. That is inarguable that we are guilty of that charge as well. And then there is Iran. Now, what's not mentioned is during the Iran-Iraq war, certainly what is talked about is that Iraq gassed Iranian troops. But what's not mentioned is that Iran also used chemical weapons against Iraqi troops. What is talked about is Saddam Hussein using mustard gas against civilians in particularly the Kurdish areas of northern Iraq. What's not talked about is Iran using chemical agents against the Kurdish areas in northern Iraq. So Saddam Hussein is not unique in that respect. George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney tend to focus on one incident, perhaps the most lethal incident of gassing during the last few weeks of the Iran-Iraq war, the village of Halabja in northern Iraq. Certainly the village was hit with mustard gas when Saddam Hussein thought that there were Iranian troops there. Iranian troops, thinking that there were Iraqi troops there, then hit the village with cyanogen chloride, a chemical agent that is much, much worse than mustard gas and which is probably responsible for the 5,000 to 6,000 deaths that are often quoted in the media. So that one instance in particular that's cited by most people as being particularly a heinous crime perpetrated by Saddam Hussein, it seems now, if you go back and look at the press reports at the time, if you go back and look at some of the information from U.S. military strategists who studied the Iran-Iraq war, most of them admit that the bulk of the casualties in Halabja were due to Iranian chemical weapons, not Iraqi chemical weapons. But that does not excuse Saddam Hussein. He has used chemical weapons against other civilian areas in Kurdistan to put down rebellious Kurdish uprisings. So he has used chemical agents, but he is not alone. Iran has also used them. Yet we're not going to war with Iran, a country that also has an active nuclear weapons program and is almost certainly seeking to develop bioweapons, probably at this point has many, many more chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons and weapons capability than Iraq does right now. Yet we're not in any hurry to go after Iran.
So one of the, I guess then, the unique thing that I have to agree with Bush when he says that Saddam is unique from the respect that both Saddam and Castro are two leaders that this current administration doesn't like, who have resisted U.S.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that has made Saddam Hussein unique, is that whether by design or simply because we've chosen him as to demonize him and make him the bad guy and then impose sanctions on his country, he has managed to take his nation out of the world economy and to remove the whole Iraqi population from global capitalism. That's pretty much what, and he's managed to defy the current political order in the West. So that's one of the things that has made him unique. But he, again, is not alone. There are other countries that are in that position as well. I mean, Iran is one, North Korea is one, Cuba is one, and there are probably others too that we're not talking about today. But
you know, one thing I thought was fascinating about the speech, especially looking at the PI headline the following morning, which said Bush pleads his case to the country, or something pretty close to that, was the fact that the three major networks didn't carry the speech. Which seems really unusual.
That was very strange, but in a way, I think there was some strange dynamic going on there. Bush administration PR reps did not ask the major stations to carry it, yet, of course, the major news stations could have carried it anyway. They chose not to, and I'm wondering how much of that is disagreement from the media over this whole pursuit of war with Iraq. And I'd also like to mention that during the week, just this discussion that we're having about Saddam Hussein using gas on Kurdish rebels and on Iranian troops kind of bolsters the argument that George Tenet made in a letter to Congress. George Tenet is the director of the CIA, made in a letter to Congress on Monday. Just at exactly the same time Bush was giving his speech, he said in his letter that the Bush administration is not correct in saying that Saddam Hussein would use weapons of mass destruction against American civilians. He would use them on the battlefield if the U.S. invaded. That was George Tenet's honest assessment of the risk of Saddam Hussein using weapons of mass destruction. That was something that I think also reflects a disagreement within the CIA and the Pentagon over whether or not to pursue war with Iraq. If you look at the Los Angeles Times, yesterday they had an article, which I think everybody should check out if they get a chance. It's probably still on their website. It was dated October 11th, an article where the Los Angeles Times reporters went and talked to some people from the CIA who said, look, we're getting pressure from Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, and they named Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz specifically in the article. They're putting pressure on CIA analysts to fudge their data to show a link between al-Qaeda and Iraq. And there are other ways that they're also putting pressure on them to make Saddam Hussein appear more evil than he really is. So that's something that people should be checking out, too, how the Bush administration is taking what's supposed to be objective analysis of the situation and trying to change it, trying to mislead the American people and make them think that the risk is greater than it really is. And I think that's causing them some enemies within the CIA and the Pentagon.
So Tenet comes out with that information, but it apparently facts did not contaminate
did not sway Congress.
Congress or the Senate.
No, and in fact, I was pretty angry to read Maria Cantwell saying that she thought the information from the CIA and the Pentagon supported allowing Bush the ability to wage war against Iraq anytime he wanted because Iraq was such a threat. Obviously, she didn't read Tennant's memo or didn't interpret it the way it was intended.
Well, obviously, she didn't read any of the faxes or listen to any of the calls from all her constituents
And in fact, Maria Cantwell, our other senator from the state of Washington, our junior senator from the state of Washington, a Democrat, didn't vote with Patty Murray against allowing Bush war powers. And I think it's because Maria Cantwell bought her election. She has no real constituency. So I think folks should call up Maria Cantwell's office and say to her, we should call Patty Murray and say thank you, but we should also call Maria Cantwell and say no thanks and gosh, well, you should remember, hon, that your stock options are not worth as much as they were when you ran the first time, so I don't think you're going to be able to buy your way back into office when you come up for re-election, you know, and write this down. I mean, the people that we should vote for who did vote against allowing war powers to President Bush were Jim McDermott, Jay Inslee, Brian Baird, and Rick Larson. And some of those folks may, you know, Jim McDermott won't have a contested re-election race, but some of those folks may, and we should be supporting them.
I know someone who had very heatedly gone into Cantwell's office to talk to her aides, mm-hmm. which actually her aides can't figure out why she did this either. They're feeling extremely dejected and obviously taking a lot of the heat for her.
Yeah.
And the person, as at the end of their talk to this aide, said, "And I'll never vote for her again." And the aide responded, "Yeah, neither will I."
Oh, wow.
So I thought that was pretty telling.
That's pretty amazing. That is really amazing.
So clearly we have a problem when our representatives are not representing us.
Yeah, and I want to just tell people who attended the marches over the weekend and the wonderful march we had on Wednesday night here in Seattle and who've been calling their representatives and been working to try and get Congress to vote against war powers for Bush, that you should not despair. We have actually already shaped the course of the Bush administration's policy on Iraq. If you will remember, he wanted to go to war. George Bush wanted to go to war earlier this year without approval from anyone. And the American people basically said, whoa, 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 wait a minute. How does Iraq relate to al-Qaeda? And Congress said to Bush, what do you mean you want to go to war? You can't go to war without our approval. And the international community said, well, wait a second. What do you mean you want to just unilaterally attack another country without reason? You know, you got to come through us first. You got to talk to the international community. And so all of us together have already slowed down this war process. And it's possible now because the international, you can bet the international community has been looking at what the American people do, you know, and they've been looking at this vote in Congress not to see, you know, if Congress approves, then we'll approve it, but to see exactly how much dissent there is and how divided the American people and the American government is over this. And I think that is what is bolstering Vladimir Putin and the French foreign minister in their opposition to allowing this U.S. resolution to go through at the U.N. that would put impossible conditions on Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, I think it's important for people, to keep that in mind. I have friends who never were involved with lobbying Congress mm-hmm. before and who actually got involved on this. And it wasn't because, you know, I pushed them to do that. They just did it on their own. Mm-hmm. And that's really inspiring. I think that's happening all across the country. And in some ways, this upping the war with Iraq has in fact invigorated and...
the peace movement, it has.
The democratic movement.
And I think it has certainly also gotten people involved in politics who have never been involved before. And I just want to tell those folks not to despair, not to think that it was for nothing, that in fact it has had an effect already.
Oh, and this is the point where you increase it. You don't.
Yeah, this is not the point where you give up and say, gosh, it didn't have any effect, so I'll just go back to watching Monday Night Football and forget about politics. I think people should be more involved than ever because we've already had an impact and we can have a much bigger one.
So, yeah, believe me, people in D.C. are taking notice, and they've altered their course multiple times because of this. So I second that motion. So... what do we got coming up? Related, you brought in some information on Harkin Energy.
Yes, and in fact, this is one of the things that the Bush administration would like us to forget about by concentrating on the Iraq War. New charges this week, a group called Harvard Watch, a group of students and faculty members at Harvard University, who actually are a watchdog group for the Harvard administration's investment policies, won the release of some financial documents this week that show that George Bush was instrumental in setting up a partnership along with Harvard University that removed debt from Harkin Energy's balance sheet. It was a similar partnership to what Enron set up with its kind of phony deals to remove debt from the balance sheet to make it look like it was in much, much better financial shape. What this had the effect of doing is it took $20 million in debt from the balance sheet. It gave Harkin an influx of cash in the form of very lucrative fees to manage the new partnership, about $100,000 a month. It brought in drilling and service fees of about $3 million in the first year alone for Harkin Energy. Harkin got a $7.5 million loan in cash that the partnership had to repay. Harkin did not have to repay it. The partnership had to repay it. Harkin was also, because of George Bush's ties to Harvard University, Harkin was allowed to pay off a $16.2 million loan it owed to Harvard by giving them assets that were worth only $14.5 million. And this whole situation really shows how Bush Jr. has been trading on his daddy's name, because it was all done in 1990 when Bush Sr. was in office, and some of the people who helped set up this deal were close associates or political supporters of George Bush Sr. Some of the things that went on in 1990 is Harkin Energy beat out larger rival energy firms to win drilling rights in Bahrain, but to take advantage of that, they had to get their house in order financially because Harkin was on the verge of default. So what happened was a supporter of George Bush Sr. bailed out Harkin in 1990 when it was about to default on its loans to Bank Boston. That person's name, I have his name here somewhere, his name was Robert Aboud. He was the head of First City Bank Corp. First City Bank Corp. took over the loans that Harkin was about to default on to Bank Boston and bailed them out. That was in 1990. Robert Stone, another supporter of George Bush Sr., he's the point man on the Harvard Investment Board for energy-related investments. He's the guy who helped Bush set up this phony off-balance sheet partnership. Now, that's something that we should be paying a lot more attention to. The media has not picked up on it, but it is a direct example of how George Bush Jr. is as guilty as some of these major corporate criminals that are being tried right now.
So, assuming that the media did pick up on this, then mm-hmm. what would be the next course of action? Would the SEC start working on this, or what?
Well, the SEC should certainly. The Bush administration should certainly turn over the SEC records of its investigation against Harkin Energy and George Bush. Bush has resisted that for months now. He's been saying that, oh, you people in the media have all the relevant information, but the fact is we don't have any of the details of the SEC investigation, and those records should be made public. We should be able to see those and see what they were able to see and see why they came to the conclusion that Sonny George Bush Jr. was not at fault. I would certainly suspect that there was some influence from the top, that George Bush Sr. influenced the SEC at that point to drop its investigation against his son. But I would certainly like to see the proof of that.
Hmm. All right. Well, moving a bit closer to home, talking about shell games with money, mm-hmm. let's talk about Mayor Nichols' budget proposals.
Oh, yeah. And I haven't had a chance to, excuse me, to read through all of the detail, but I have looked at the big numbers, and just from a look at those numbers only, I have to say that there are two things about the budget that really, really concern me. The first is that there are increases for some departments. Now, we're talking about a budget hole that we're not getting in as much revenue as last year, so there have to be budget cuts. You would think the first thing that the mayor would do would be to freeze the budgets in all departments and then start looking at places to cut and then try to make those cuts spread out over the whole budget. Well, Nichols has not done that. He has actually budgeted increases for neighborhoods and development, for police, for fire, for the criminal justice system, for utilities, and for transportation, including some very, very questionable vanity projects like widening sidewalks that Nichols is trumpeting as his big contribution to the city of Seattle. But the numbers are way down, and he has cut severely parks and recreation, money for the Seattle Public Library, and most importantly, he has budgeted a 25% cut for health and human services. That, in my opinion, is absolutely inexcusable. That is execrable. I think he should be roasted over a large fire for that. That is just inexcusable. And that's just in the first year. The other part of the other problem with the budget is that he just assumes that we're going to have lower revenue in 2003 only. It's a biannual budget. It's supposed to cover the years 2003 and 2004. In 2004, his budget figures shoot back up, which to me is absolutely irresponsible. But if you also look at 2004 a little more closely, you see that the numbers shoot back up for neighborhoods and development, police, fire, the criminal justice system, utilities, more of Nichols' vanity transportation projects, but they're cut down again for health and human services. So they take a cut both in 2003 and 2004. That, to me, is not just inexcusable, it's criminal. And I think people should be talking to their city council members about this. You should be writing letters and calling your city council members and asking them to please do your best to restore funding to the Health and Human Services Department.
I know they've been having some public forums hearings on the budget that I know
they have.
Week.
I think they also had one just this last week. People can go to the City Council website and check out when they're going to be having their future forums on the budget. And certainly I urge you to attend and to speak up about this. This is just inexcusable.
I saw, and I think it was today's paper, an article that Nichols is also proposing a little $27 million loan to finish the Opera House.
Yeah.
The Macomb Opera House.
Yeah, as if there aren't people in town who don't have a few extra millions laying around to
right.
help finish the Opera House.
You know, Macaw, whose Teledisc venture is falling out of the sky.
I know.
So, Greg...
So that's,
Greg appears to be willing to spend other people's money for his projects.
For his projects, yeah. I think his sidewalk improvement project has got to be the silliest thing I've ever seen. I mean, you got to look at that as saying, well, yeah, it's a nice project, but is it necessary? And no, it's not necessary when you're talking about cutting things like the Civil Rights Commission, when you're talking about getting rid of certain health and human services programs altogether. I mean, that is not something that we can stand by and just let happen.
Yeah, three different commissions he's nixing, all made up of volunteers.
Yeah.
So he's doing it.
He's cutting them in order to cut the paid staff people who do kind of the grunt work for them.
Right, which would be three half-time positions.
Yeah, it's not going to save a lot of money.
No, and in fact, we're going to have representatives from each of those commissions on our show next week, next Saturday at 7:30, mm-hmm. So we'll be talking about that further. We only have a couple minutes left, and we wanted to put in another plug for the demonstration going on currently at the Lillian Apartments.
Yes, indeed. The Lillian Apartments are at risk for being demolished. Low-income housing advocates have said that these apartments should be saved to help stock up on low-income housing in Seattle, which is losing its low-income buildings right and left. Vulcan Properties, owned by Paul Allen, has stripped the buildings of much of their fixtures and tried to turn the Lillian Apartments into an uninhabitable building. Right now, there are people down there trying to save the Lillian Apartments from the wrecking ball. So if you want to run down there and join them, you should do that.
And Lillian Apartments are located in the Cascade neighborhood, right in the same neighborhood we are broadcasting from at 1258 John Street. That's two blocks west of REI. So, talking this week with Maria Tomchik, who is co-editor at Eat the State. And Maria, tell us
where to find Eat the State.
Eat the State.
Eat the State. It just came out this week, so there's a new issue out. Can be found in coffee shops, bookstores, restaurants, bars. Can be found in the King County Public Libraries all over the county. It's free. You don't have to pay anything for it. You can also check us out on the web at www.eatthestate. That's all one word, eatthestate.org. Not com, as some people think. It's O-R-G. And if you have any tips, if you want to volunteer to help us distribute the paper or write for us, if you have any questions or comments about what you hear on the program, you can call our voice message number, which is 903-9461.